Accession number 30062, reel 10.
Yep. We're in the middle of that one.
Yeah. So Bobby Allen.
Yes. So Bobby Allen decided he was going to get hold of a larger ship, a well-armed ship, or two or three of them, which could fire from a further range. And identify by using the PT boats the position of F-lighter convoys, and then using the advanced knowledge of where they were going and what speed, and bring the greater firepower. And he discovered that there was some landing craft gun, which LCGs, there were all sorts of, there were LCGs, LCFs, that was landing craft flak with rockets all over them to fire at the enemy coast before a landing, all sorts of things. LCR, that was rockets, flak with great sheets of stuff. Anyway, these guns had two 4.7-inch guns manned by Royal Marines. And Bobby Allen himself went out in the PT, which had been invited to join, and acted as the director or admiral of the whole shoot. And there were MTBs and MGBs associated with the venture. And then they would find them. May take them 6 hours to get into position, because there were speeds to worry about, you know, getting the LCGs into position. And then they would fire these shells, and the gunnery was so good and well directed, especially with the information from the radar, that they did in fact wipe out three or four. On each occasion they did it, three or four F-lighters completely, and they didn't even know what hit them. They were, in fact, firing their anti-aircraft guns, thinking that they were being bombed, and they were being hit by shells from the 4.7-inch. Quite incredible gunnery. So all that went on, and we have many actions of one sort and another, until I reckon that 658 was in action about 23 times, which was an incredible amount in 6 months that we were at Bastia. And just before we finished at Bastia, I think it was very early June, one of our flotilla with a Canadian CO and with I haven't said that I'd become first lieutenant and gunnery officer a long time before this. In fact, it was very soon after our first surface action. And then all these, when we were in Bastia, I was first lieutenant all that time. And we were suddenly told that we would be going round to the because there was more scope now for boats of this sort in the Dalmatian islands in Yugoslavia, which were ideal for small boats that could tuck away and emerge to disturb shipping. And that so it was the Adriatic for us. But on our way, on one occasion, we had this Canadian boat behind us, and she suddenly blew up. And this was an acoustic mine they'd hit, and we'd gone over the mine first, and it happened to us right at the end of the war as well. It's the first boat is in a way lucky, and the second one's unlucky. And that one hit it under the bow, and I was very worried indeed that they'd lose an enormous number of men. They actually didn't, because there weren't, there were only the guns crews, which was about three or four around each gun, but all the rest of the crew were further back, and they, in fact, most of them were picked up by the third and fourth boats in the unit. And I was very worried that my friend, my old pilot, when I'd been first lieutenant, he was now a spare first lieutenant for the flotilla, and he had just walked across onto the other boat, and I needn't have been worried at all. And funnily enough, he was mine twice, and so was my friend Derek, but that was still to come. And so we went down to Malta and had 3 weeks there, preparing to go and getting absolutely on top line for going round to the Adriatic. So we landed round at Brindisi, where we'd got an old Italian seaplane carrier called the Miraglia, she looked after our needs, a complete engineering base aboard the seaplane carrier. There, Bobby Allen wasn't round there, he stayed, and in fact, the CO that we'd picked up after sinking his boat was now the commanding officer of this whole unit, of this seaplane carrier and the base, Coastal Force Base Miraglia, and in Brindisi. It was in this period that I managed to... I wonder when this was, no. It was a bit later. Because in mid-August, we went round there, beginning of July, I should think, 44. We're in 1944 now. And we were beginning to operate from Brindisi across into the islands. It was always talked about in the islands, because we'd been, MTBs had been operating there for the whole of 1944, since about January 44, there was no base actually, except a small island, the island of Vis, V-I-S, which had a lieutenant commander, a very well-known later lieutenant commander, as the senior naval officer, whose job was to operate us, as he was working all the time as liaison with the partisans, because on the island of Vis, it was Tito's headquarters, and there were 9,000 partisans on this tiny island. There were two commandos, two units of commandos. Each commando, I don't think they were as big as they are now, but a commando now, 40, 42 and 45 are the three commandos now, and they're 700 each. And there was a half squadron of Hurricanes. I think we had Hurricanes, not Spitfires, and they would be there to assist as much as possible anything with the partisans, to assist in their landings and all the rest of it, and also to act in our usual way on patrols to attack any shipping coming down the Yugoslav coast down towards Dubrovnik, where there were large garrisons of Germans, Split and all the other big ports down the Dalmatian coast. And this was so far out, 30 miles out from Split, And apparently they were, once it started with a coastal force base there, and they began sinking convoys, there was a great debate in the German high command whether it would be a good idea to attack Wies as a base, because it was proving such a thorn in their side. But in fact, in the end, it was regarded as being not as important to all the other things that the Germans, because we were holding up in Yugoslavia 14 divisions of German troops, which otherwise would have been either up in on the Western Front or out in the East, in Russia first and so on. So the effect of coastal forces, particularly on Tito's partisans, was enormous, because almost at the same time Crete and Greece had fallen, but they were beginning to be recaptured and driven up north through the Balkans from there. The officer I mentioned to you, who was called S.N.O. Wies, and in other words, Snow Wies, was apparently affectionately known by other people of his own rank in the Royal Navy as Snow White and his Seven Dwarfs, because he was looking after all these MTBs. But he now is a marvellous old admiral, who, in fact, is 92 or 3 now. And he was commanding officer of HMS Belfast before it was decommissioned, and chairman of the committee that got hold of the Belfast and put it into place and financed it and all the rest of it as part of the Imperial War Museum.
That's quite a life.
Yeah.
And, that's a good legacy.
He's a marvellous chap, and he is absolutely 100% a coastal forces man. And we must have talked last time about my name being Rover.
Yes, we should talk, definitely. You need to tell me that. Tell me that, yes.
But he phones me up frequently because I'm supposed to be the guru of coastal forces because of research on the books. And if he wants to know something about, he was writing his own book, and he wanted to know a bit more about coastal forces. And he's very, very deaf, and therefore also speaks very loudly. And he rings up, and it's usually Wynne who answers the phone. And he says, "Hello, my dear girl, is Rover there?" But he's a marvellous chap. And he had a terrific war, and he even, this is a by-part because it was nothing to do with us, the port of Bari, just north of Brindisi, was bombed most horribly by the Germans, and because there were two convoys in this large harbour, one came in and the other one hadn't finished unloading. They were totally decimated, and there was a flotilla of MTBs in there, and he happened to be there trying to get equipment to take over for the partisans. That was one of his jobs, was to help supply them. And Bari was so heavily bombed, it was the worst, they say, the worst since Pearl Harbor. And unfortunately, one of the Americans, this is well documented now and in the public domain, I think, wasn't for a long time, but there was American, what do they call, Liberty ships, were carrying as a reserve in case of the Germans used it first, of gas, chlorine. Mm. Yeah. Yes. Anyway, a great big carboys of gas on which all went into the harbour, and a lot of MTB men went out trying to pull people into the boats and got awful burns, dear old Morgan Giles, who was Snowvis, he apparently did whatever, but he's never told the story, and he doesn't want it told, but he got the George Medal, not the George Cross, I think, yes, George Medal, I think, so for whatever he did there, but he won't. I've asked him donkeys a number of times, but anyway, that's... Now, where were we?
Just before we go on, I think I wondered if you'd tell the story of how you got the nickname Rover.
Oh yes, way back when we were in, we were back in Malta three or four times for repairs because it was our back base, and on one of them, I think it must have been Christmas '43, I discovered that there was a deep sea Rover Scout crew in Malta, and when I was in. I'd been a scout all my life, I'd been a King Scout, just right up to the start of the war. And I was then asked, when I was in training, I joined the Deep Sea Rover Scouts, which was just an extension of the scout movement for those who were in ships and would be going all over the world. And the idea was that wherever possible in a port, there would be somebody offering hospitality of any sort or help to people, and naturally, who were scouts. Naturally, in Malta, where there were an enormous number of ships around, there was a unit of the Malta Deep Sea Rover Scout crew that met fortnightly or something, or weekly, in the crypt of the cathedral in Valletta. And when I heard about this, I went to see what it was like, and then I started going regularly for the three or four weeks we were there. And my skipper, the Canadian, Corny, discovered this and immediately nicknamed me Rover, and it stuck. And it's still totally common among all my Mediterranean. And last week, I wonder if I've mentioned it to you, we have this enormous celebration in Portsmouth, Gosport, where we had a huge parade and closed the central base of Coastal Forces veterans, because it's going down so fast in numbers. We decided that we'd continue it on a local basis, but not on a central basis. And the number of people who came up to me and talked to me and called me Rover, because it's commonly known, they've all read my book, so nearly they were a marvellous market for my royalties, I must admit, the chaps themselves. Anyway, that's that now. Is that good enough?
That was beautiful. And the only other story I was thinking about was when you said that Corny sent you out to get uniforms at one point.
Oh, yes, that's right. That was the one example that made it totally valuable in Corny's eyes, was that he sent me very early on when we first arrived in Malta. It was obviously too hot to be wearing dungarees for the crew to work in, and he sent me over to see if I could get at the big base in HMS St. Angelo, the Castello St. Angelo in Malta, where the flag officer in charge, no, the Vice Admiral Malta, all his officers were there, and I went over there to see if I could get any khaki shorts and shirts to go to issue to the crew. And I went over there in fear and trembling, because I was still a midshipman at the time, And I was shown into the office of a lieutenant commander, and obviously didn't pull much weight that way, and I expected to be dismissed. It did seem that he wasn't going to be very helpful. And I suddenly realized that he was wearing the wristlet badge with a scout badge on it, which denoted that he belonged to the Deep Sea Rover Scouts. And I pulled up my sleeve, and it's like the Freemasons, isn't it? And he said, how long you been in there? etc., etc. What can I do for you? And I went back on board with two complete sets of a khaki uniform for everybody on board, and I was the flavour of the month. And Corny never faulted the Rover Scouts game.
I bet.
Now,
we need to get back from the digression.
I think we were just about to, we had got to Brindisi, but we hadn't got into operations, hadn't we? It took until August the 14th / 15th, the way the Navy always puts it, the night of the 14th, 15th. No, 17th, 18th. My memory's going. I never forget this. And it was the finest battle we ever fought, and it was called the Battle of the Mellette Channel. And the Battle of the Mellette Channel involved the three musketeers, the three Canadians who'd been at school together in Vancouver. It involved Derek as well, who was the first lieutenant of Tommy Ladner, who was always just behind us. And the three of us, with Doug Maitland, the senior Canadian, by terms of not age, but joining the RCMVR. And I think he was 3 days senior to Corny. And by this time, the unit was very settled, everything. We always knew what everyone was going to do. And with the three of us being together, it was quite marvellous. And by this time, Doug, the senior officer, who'd been the leader of the fraternization with the PT boats, had got himself an SO radar, and he'd bought it for a crate of scotch, and not bought it really, but it was an arrangement, a semi-official raid. Obviously, they didn't give them away, but by the end of the war, all eight or nine boats had them, and we had them in 658. It was a pot on top of the mast, a smaller mast instead of a tall one, because we didn't need a radar thing to go up there like this. It was going round like this all the time. So he had his own radar now, didn't have to rely on a PT boat. And he, his radar picked up a whole convoy of six or seven craft coming down the coast between Split and Dubrovnik, when they had to go through this narrow channel between the mainland and the island of Mellette, MJLET. And about 50 miles north of Dubrovnik. And having spotted this on his radar, Corny, we got all together and shouted to each other, and he gave his orders that we were going to sit right under the cliff, because all these places in Yugoslavia go straight down like that. It's deep water immediately. So we were right under the cliff, and absolutely invisible to any ships going down, because totally dark background, and we were dark, of course, dark grey, and so that we wouldn't be seen. And then we waited for this convoy to come, and as soon as they nearly got there, Doug ordered, his first order was, "Tommy, light please." And their six-pounder had, no, the pom-pom then, we didn't have six-pounders until later, except for the goose gun, but the pom-pom had star shell sights, shells, and off they went as soon as they were ordered. And he was waiting for this word of command, and he fired these star shell all over this convoy, all lit up like a glare showing the whole thing. I had been under star shell from the enemy a few times, and it's the most frightening feeling. You feel as though you're naked in the middle of the street, you know, and it really is awful. And anyway, this, as they came by, each one of us opened fire, and it all the way along this convoy, most terrific thing. And they couldn't deviate, they had to follow one another right and be suffered all the time. There were two great big schooners, much bigger than us, with high poop astern, and a large number of guns, some of them not much bigger than ours, and a lot of ordinary machine guns and all the rest. But they couldn't fire them very much at first while they were under fire. It was when they tried to recover after that that they did cause some trouble. But we hardly had any firing back on the first run at all. And when we got to the end of them, we went up the other side on the way back, travelling in the same direction as they were. And I suppose that's when we were most vulnerable, because the bigger ones up the in the front of the convoy were getting prepared to open fire again. And on our first run along the other side, when the shells we fired, any that, obviously not all of them hit ships, and they would hit the undergrowth, the Mackie, along the shore. And there was this great illumination behind them. It was the most amazing thing. It all worked for us both ways. And but we were the only boat hit. Neither Doug nor Tommy was hit at all. And one of the shells hit the engine room, a big shell, and three of our engines out of the four were put out of action. So we were told to take up Taylor's Charlie, which none of us like being Taylor's Charlie. That was that. But we did keep on going, and we got one of them going. We had this absolutely marvellous motor mechanic who was an absolute prince of motor mechanics. He was very tanned and extraordinarily manly, a big chap, and he always, up down in the engine room, it was so hot, and that he wore just his little shorts, you know, down there, as most of the stokers did too. And he came rushing up to see the captain and said, "I've got to get water from underneath your feet, sir." So the whole of the deck of the bridge opened up to a hatch, and then there was some connection to a water supply, and he took a hose down into the engine because he had all this fire to and they were incredible, because they could climb onto the hot pipes of the cooling pipes and things.